we were in London just now with our task force, we met with your group, we met with some others in East London, for example. There is, in fact, a spectrum of groups engaged in this ideological discussion and kind of more tactically in neighborhoods in counter-radicalization, and the British government is involved with a whole bunch of them. The Killiam Foundation is in part there to advise government on policies, you said, but some of the other groups that the government, and not just in the UK, in other countries as well, that they're working with are groups that the governments and the groups themselves describe not as jihadi Salafists, but as political Salafists, meaning not people who are adhering to a takfiri ideology and who are calling for attacks against the West, but individuals who still want Sharia law, including in the West, individuals who, as one person we met with said to me, still support resistance in Iraq and in Palestine, just not in Great Britain or the United States. What is the interaction between Killiam Foundation with groups like this? What is the nature of the debate within the larger community of activists who are trying to flush these things out? And what is your policy towards the British government in terms of its cooperation with such groups, which seems to stand in contrast to the position of the Killiam Foundation?
That's a very important question, and I think just to start off, I'll talk about the difference in the communities. The Muslim community isn't one community. It's more than one community. And a nuanced approach is always helpful. And I generally talk about conservative Muslims. Let's first of all say there are non-Islamists and Islamists. In the non-Islamists camp, i.e. those who do not believe Islam is an ideology, but rather just a faith, in that side of things, there in that camp, there are those who are conservative, who adhere to a medieval interpretation of religion and believe that that interpretation is still valid for today. And there are those who are relatively progressive. And each one of those two subcategories has its schools. On the Islamist side, you have those who are political Islamists, those who believe in entry-level politics, engaging through the electoral process as a fifth column to take over governments. Because, of course, Islam is an ideology. It must rule. Those who are revolutionary Islamists, such as Hizb ut-Tahrir, who believe in instigating military coups. And thirdly, the jihadists, the militant Islamists. So it's not all black and white. There are nuances there. The political Islamists are not terrorists. The revolutionary Islamists believe in military coups. They don't target non-combatants. And the jihadists obviously do. Now, there's a danger of assuming that the only problem are the jihadists. That the only problem is the tactic of terrorism rather than the ideology itself and those who adhere to it. The Quilliam Foundation has, as has been rightly pointed out, criticized on a number of different occasions, quite forthrightly, Islamists of all persuasions, and we don't pull any punches on that. We criticize Islamists of all persuasions for turning Islam into a political ideology, and I'll go into why we do that. But we also have not criticized but pushed conservative non-Islamists to try and become a bit more progressive. And what that's done is it's turned certain conservative elements, put us out of favor with them, and Islamists have started to try and use those conservative elements to mount a critique against the Quilliam Foundation. Because Islamists will find common ground with conservatives in the fact that they are both looking to have some form of social conservative policy. The only difference is Islamists want to rule with that social conservative policy, and conservative Muslims will simply be happy with the fact that their family and their daughters aren't walking around without head coverings. And what's happened, the danger is of assuming that the only problem is terrorism. And that's the danger which we advise against with the UK government. And there are certain partners which we constantly advise against in terms of working with. Because if we remember and recall the history of Islamism, what we realize is terrorism as a tactic and Al-Qaeda as an organization or a loose affiliation is very, very recent compared to the historical problems that Islamism has created. It starts with the 1920s Muslim Brotherhood, who used to have their own, incidentally, military wing. Their founder was assassinated only after they assassinated the Prime Minister of Egypt. They abandoned their military wing, fair enough, but the ideology was then crystallized by Nabahani, the founder of HT. In 1953, Nabahani, the founder of HT, said that the three core aims of Hizb ut-Tahrir were, one, to overthrow every single Arab and Middle Eastern regime, to overthrow them militarily through a military coup, two, to replace them with a global expansionist caliphate, and three, to use that caliphate to destroy Israel and to then conquer the rest of the world. In the year 2008, you hear those three aims from Ayman al-Zawahiri. the deputy of Osama bin Laden. Those three aims were articulated in 1953 by Nabhani, the founder of HT. It's the same theory. It's the same ideology. All that happened was a tactical shift. And that tactical shift is that Al-Qaeda consider, like HT, that the whole Muslim world and then therefore the rest of the world is a land of war, Dar al-Harb. Hezb al-Tahrir also believe that the whole world is a land of war. The war, the tactic in that war for Hezb al-Tahrir is to recruit from the armies to overthrow the regimes because that's the more efficient way of doing it. The jihadists turn around and said, you're in war, we're in war. You want to use the force of the army to overthrow the regime, we'll create our own army and we'll do the same thing. And you can see when I explain it like that, there's actually not much difference. The only difference is when you create your own army, you start targeting non-combatants because you're at war with the whole society. And Hezb al-Tahrir are a bit more efficient in their method. They try and recruit from an existing army simply to overthrow the regime itself. And the Takfiri ideology emerged from the articulation that Sayyid Qutb wrote about in Milestones, but actually came from Nabhani. The founder of HT was the first Islamist theoretician to put down the notion that the whole world is Dar al-Harb, or the land of war. Sayyid Qutb simply built upon that. When he spoke about the Jahili society, or the idolatrous society that's un-Islamic, when he spoke of mosques being Ma'abid al-Jahiliyyah, or temples of ignorance, he didn't refer to them as mosques, referred to them as temples, because of course Islam is absent. These ideas were built upon the theory that Nabhani laid in 1953. Where did Nabhani come from himself? In turn, he was inspired by the general expression of the ideology coming from the Muslim Brotherhood, with his links in Egypt, and the ideological concepts that he used from Arab socialism, because he was a former Arab Ba'athist. He merged ideological concepts from communism with the expression of Islamism that emerged in a general form with the Brotherhood and set up HT. HT then acted as a direct catalyst for jihadists to emerge. And as a long-term policy basis, it's insufficient to think that the problem is just with terrorism. There's no such thing as the war on terror because terror is a tactic. It's a tactic which will come and go based upon expedient reasons, expediency. The problem is the ideology itself. Now, I'm not advocating banning Islamists. I have done so, I have not done so even in the UK. I've gone on record opposing banning HT because I think you have to draw the line at violence. But what I am saying, that does not mean just because we don't ban them that they're not a problem. That doesn't mean that just because they're not banned that we can't make it taboo to be associated with them. We don't invite them onto platforms. We don't normalize them, just as you would not invite somebody from the KKK or in our case the BNP. And so with just coming back to your question to end off, yes, there's a problem in engaging with the wrong partners and empowering the wrong partners. And we're in constant discussion with the UK government. And I believe on a national level, they're understanding this a lot better. On a local level, there are still many problems. And as we speak right now, there's a conference, thousands of people are there in the O2 Arena in London, organized by Islam Expo. And that was funded by London's mayor, former mayor Ken Livingstone. London taxpayers' money is funding this conference. And the directors of Islam Expo are Azam Tamimi, the Hamas representative in the UK, and Anas al-Tikriti, whose father was the head of the Brotherhood in Iraq, who received money from the London mayor to organize thousands of Muslims to go to the O2 Arena to have a massive conference, which is occurring today as we speak. Now, that was a mistake made by the former mayor. Let's hope the current mayor doesn't make the same mistakes.
Let's open this now to questions and answers. I'll take everybody as I see them on a first-come, first-served basis. Please talk into the mic, introduce yourself, and if you are in the back, please come forward to the mic in the middle, and we'll start right here. Push the button if it's
okay.
Not on.
Is that on? Yes. Congratulations on a most lucid explanation of everything that happened and of your perception of HT. You referred partially to the Amnesty International person who sort of adopted you as a political prisoner and the fact that he was technically your enemy, somebody you opposed, his ideology, but who supported you as a political prisoner. What other aspects of the influences on you when you were in prison in Egypt brought about what I may call a sort of political conversion, a sense that what you had been engaged in previously was completely wrong? What were the factors, and was there any decisive moment in your sort of epiphany, if we can call it that?
There was There was an epiphany, but it was much later on after I left prison, and that was what to do with the change, and that was the idea to set up a foundation. But the process in prison was a long, drawn-out, gradual change. As I said, my heart was opened up through the Amnesty International campaign, and specifically with John Cornwell, who would without fail write letters to me every week. And the man is still alive, he's still there in the UK, I'm still in touch with him, and in fact, we're in the middle of a project at the moment where the national television would broadcast a joint venture film between he and I in a dialogue, just to highlight that story. But other than the Amnesty case, there was another element, which was that I had the fortune of being in prison with people of across the whole political spectrum. The leaders and founders of Al-Gama'a al-Islamiyya, the Egypt's former largest terrorist organization, that had renounced Islamism and terrorism in around the year 2000 in a process that they called Mubadarat Waqf al-Unf, or the ceasefire initiative, which ended up as, it started as a ceasefire, it ended up as Tasheeh al-Mafaheem, a series of books that they wrote correcting the misguided concepts. Now, I was imprisoned with these guys. I also had the advantage of being in prison and the privilege of being in prison with Ayman Noor, the runner-up to the Egyptian presidential elections, who was duly imprisoned after he took second place. second only to Mubarak. Come on, guys, he did really well. And also Saad al-Din Ibrahim, the professor who was also in prison for criticizing what he termed Jumhurukiyya. Now, if anyone here is conversant in Arabic, there are two terms in Arabic, Jumhuriyya and Mulkiyya. Jumhuriyya means the republic, and Mulkiyya means a monarchy. Saad al-Din wrote an article called Jumhurukiyya, where he combined the two, i.e. the republic and the monarchy together, because Mubarak was said to be grooming his son for the presidency after his death. And they imprisoned Saad al-Din for that article, and the other accusation was receiving EU funds to monitor elections. Now, I had 4 years of my life to discuss with people like this, former terrorists who had abandoned their ideology, liberal politicians, sociologists, professors, assassins of Sadat, who had not been executed in that case, who would also by that time realize that perhaps it wasn't such a bright idea. They had 24 years in prison to come to that conclusion. And so that 4 years of constant debate and engagement and discussion, having also learned Arabic by that time and having access to classical Islamic sources, and to see that the Islamist ideology was entirely absent from classical Islamic sources, led me to realize that I'd been sold a lie. But for that to happen, essentially, it was essential, first of all, for my heart to open, and that's how Amnesty came involved. Thank you.
Richard up front, and then we'll move back.
Thank you, and thanks for the fascinating talk. One sort of rather basic thing I just wanted to ask you, though. You talk about this idea of irreligious modernity and man-made ideology. But at the same time, you refer to them as Islamists, and you talk about jihad and stuff like that. Isn't using those terms rather pushing your constituency away from you and towards a belief that Islam and the ideas of Hizb ut-Tahrir and Al-Qaeda and so on are in some way compatible?
I think everyone's British in this audience.
Oh, sorry about that. I should have put on an accent.
Right, yeah. I thought maybe we finally colonized the States again. So, okay.
That didn't go so well the first time.
Yeah, it didn't go so well, did it? No. Right, Islamism as a term. My take on this is that there is an ideology there. It exists, and we have to name it something. And what do we name it? Well, when we talk about socialism, we don't understand automatically by using the word socialism that social workers are necessarily socialists. But there's a reason for why the word social is in socialism, because socialists justify their policies through their so-called concern for society and social welfare. When we talk about communism, we don't think that community workers or communitarians are communists, but communists justify their policies through the need or the justification that they're concerned about the collective, the people, you know, which is one thing for them. So when we talk about Islamism, we don't mean that Muslims are Islamists or terrorists, but Islamists justify their ideology through Islam, and the suffix "ism" is there to demonstrate that in fact it's a political ideology as opposed to Islam, the faith. We feel it's vital that through this distinction and by putting the suffix "ism" on the end, that we are in fact making it clear that it's a modern political ideology, because this "ism" is about modern ideologies. And we feel that in fact we're solving that problem, because it's so much easier for people to say, oh, there's Islam and there's Islamism, rather than to say there's Islam and there's political Islam, which causes an ambiguity, or to say there's Islam and there's extreme Islam. But when you say there's Islam of faith and Islamism a modern political ideology, now in the last event, again, you know, Jeff would get annoyed if I went into it, but in the last event, I went into a lot of detail about the ideology itself and its refutation, with the hope to demonstrate the extent to which it is very modern. And what Islamists have done is they've taken entirely modern-day political paradigms, such as sovereignty, state, law, constitutions, canons, and codification of law. They've taken these modern-day paradigms and they've superimposed them upon traditional religious code of conduct. What they wanted to do is take the medieval interpretation of religious law and impose it through modern political paradigms such as constitution, state, and codification of laws. So they've merged modern political paradigms with ancient religious tradition, and Islamism arose. And our identification of that is to demonstrate that rather than being authentic, to summarize that point, Islamists, for example, talk about the Islamic State as being a fundamental pillar of the Islamic creed. And we say something as simple as, well, if that was the case, then the word for state in Arabic is dawla. You may be interested to learn that dawla as a word is not referred to once in the Quran, nor in the prophetic tradition, and in fact didn't even exist in the Arabic language up until modern times, where they needed the equivalent in Arabic for the modern European word state. Same with sovereignty, a word that does not exist once in the Quran or the Sunnah or the Arabic language. So when they say sovereignty is for God, it's a modern discussion they're having, the word sovereignty in Arabic being siyada. Or ideology, Islam being a political ideology, which Hizb ut-Tahrir would insist, as the first line we teach in the book called Nizam al-Islam in those indoctrination circles, is that Islam is an ideology, not a religion. The word ideology in Arabic is, guess what, folks? Ideology. They say ideologiya, because it does not exist in the Arabic language, not referred to once. The word referred to in the Quran for Islam is deen. Deen means religion. It's the same word used to refer to Christianity and Judaism. So by having these sorts of discussions, we demonstrate that if a word is absent in a language, it's pretty much because the guys didn't have that concept. If they did, they would have had a word for it. And so I think it helps to distinguish between Islam and Islamism to show that there's actually some modern discussion they're having. Now, modernity is not wrong. What's wrong is to claim that your modernity is ancient divine religion. But when we can separate those two, we can then have legitimate political debate about what the way forward is without getting religion involved.
Okay, I'm trying to take you in order. Sinu, Ted Ketu. Use the microphone on the table.
Okay.
Make sure the button's pushed.
Yeah. When Westerners go to a university and study about Islam, we're not studying Islam, but we're learning about Islam, generally it's treated as a very much a holistic religion, much like Orthodox Jew. Much like Orthodox Jews, Muslims have prescriptions for every facet or almost every facet of life, either based on, you know, Sunnah or et cetera. I've always felt what you're saying is that the Islamists or Islamism cherry picks. They selectively take what they want and ignore what they don't want. But yet one thing that you do get taught when you're a foreigner or you're a non-Muslim studying Islam is that Islam does not make a sharp distinction, or much of a distinction at all, really, between the political sphere and other spheres, that it's all, again, holistic, that it's, you know, and indeed, the very first split within Islam between Shia and Sunni was over who inherits, who's the caliph, who's the legitimate caliph. So how do you deal with your critics when they say, look, we don't make these distinctions? That's very good for the West, but not for us.
Excellent question. And let's start with the history. Traditionally, historically, Sunni and Shia have both kept their jurisprudence away from politics. Up until the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the invention of the theory of Walayat al-Faqih, the Shia were of the belief that God will send a Messiah, and until he sends the Messiah, we don't want anything to do with politics, which is why they were able to live in Sunni-dominated countries. The Sunnah, throughout history, the development of the Islamic schools of jurisprudence occurred completely and entirely separate from the caliphs, who would rule with pretty much secular law. You know, they would rule based upon the interests of whatever they deemed was in the interests of their entity. To the extent that at one time the founder of the Maliki school, known as Imam Malik, was asked by the caliph, can we adopt your book, the Muwatta, as the official jurisprudence of the of Sultanate? And he said no, because that would stifle creativity and religious debate. And so historically we found that the Islamic schools of interpretation emerged entirely separate from the state. Muslims never had the need for the whole bloody Reformation and detaching religion from politics, because it always was detached, up until they responded to European thought. And they responded in juxtaposition to Europeans as a form of resistance. Well, you guys have separated religion from politics. Well, you're the colonialists. We're going to do the opposite to you. Of course, everything has to be the opposite. We're going to do the opposite and merge religion with politics. And that began with the Ottoman state, with the Tanzimat reforms and the Majalla, which was a sincere but nevertheless misguided attempt at reform. The Ottoman state collapsed, but the Brotherhood turned it into an ideology in resistance to colonialism and King Farouk and my country's involvement in Egypt. So I think that historically there's never been a problem. And one of the manifestations or one of the effects of Islamism and its success is that it's infiltrated Western teaching of Islam to teach Islam in this way, that it is in fact a complete ideology. Yes, Islamic traditional Islamic religious Sharia does cover the code of conduct for everything, but then so does Jewish Talmudic law. That doesn't mean Judaism is an ideology, a political ideology. What it means is that if I was to follow the medieval interpretations, when I eat, I do it in accordance to my religious instruction. When I sleep, I do the same. When I get married, I do the same. But these are my individual actions. Why does that imply that the state has to enforce that on me? Maybe I choose to sin. Now, traditionally, a Muslim who chooses to sin is responsible for his own sin and has to repent himself for that. And the state didn't intervene in that. So I ask the question to an Islamist and I say, okay, you've got a case, theft. There's a punishment in the Quran mentioned for theft. We can dispute the interpretation of that because I believe the Ottomans, they settled that question when they said that the Hudud laws are repealed. They actually, the traditional Islamists, the Islamic theologians, repealed the penal code in the Ottoman state. Islamists want to bring it back. But okay, I'll give you that. There's a punishment there for theft. But then that's pretty much common sense that you punish theft. But what about covering the head? Where's the punishment in the Quran or the Sunnah for a woman who refuses to cover her head? Why do you insist it must be a crime? Why must it be illegal when there's not even a punishment revealed there whatsoever? Isn't that a religious innovation known in Arabic as bid'ah, which surely as a religious Muslim you should be opposed to bid'ah? You're opposed to innovation in religion as a heresy. So you guys have introduced the heresy, not you, of course. So what I'm saying is that then we understand that the effects of Islamism is that even the way it's taught in the West as a comprehensive ideology is problematic. But rather, yes, the Sharia in the Middle Ages was quite comprehensive in covering your individual code of conduct, but that doesn't mean that that individual comprehensive code of conduct has to be applied on a state level. It just means that you have a comprehensive moral guidance, which you may choose to adhere to and you may choose not to.
Yes.
Carl Gershman from the National Endowment for Democracy.
Is your button pushed?
Yeah. Can't hear me?
I hear you now.
Okay. You spoke as a British Muslim and called for a Western Islam growing out of your experiences in the UK. And what you're speaking about is really, derives from the experiences of Muslims where they're in a minority, in a majority society, and the way they're treated, and you explain your own experiences. But the real problem is, as you said, in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, in these other countries. Do you have, first of all, anything to say about that in terms of how those problems should be dealt with? Is it worthwhile to think in terms of a more global strategy to try to deal with this problem? And do you, through the Killiam Institute, seek to network with people internationally to develop a coordinated theoretical, political, ideological response to this challenge?
Absolutely, 100%. We've already done that through Europe. At our launch in April, we had representatives from various different countries in Europe, Denmark, Italy, Germany, and others, Austria. And we are doing it throughout the world. So as I am now here in America, our co-director, Ed Hussein, was in Egypt, networking there on behalf of a delegation that he headed up, organized by the Foreign Office to do the same work there. And we're interested in, very soon, in fact, we're going to Pakistan, because that's one of the countries where I set up HT. It is a global problem, and globalization means we have to respond to it in a global way. And we have something to say about the Middle East. And what we say is that, let's take Egypt again as a case study. If we were just to have snapshot elections today, then because of the lack of a credible alternative, Ikhwan would likely win. Now, that's a problem. So what we say is that we need to encourage civil society. We need to encourage free press, free debate. We need to start supporting people like Ayman Noor, who's in prison. We need to start supporting the liberal voices and encourage a free and open society so a credible opposition can emerge, so you don't have a takeover through democracy by Islamists. And that means our policies need to reflect that. And I think there's a lot of things we can say about that. But generally, I think, just to say, we have to start encouraging civil society before political reform. Yes.
Hi, my name is Mitchell Putnick. I'm the U.S. representative of B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights organization. And what I wanted to ask, your theory of a Western Islam seems to speak mostly to Muslims in Europe, in the United States. But when you're talking about Islamism and the effect it has in the Middle East, what we see is that groups like, for example, Hezbollah or also Hamas operate sort of outside of law. And even when their governments or whatever you want to call the Palestinian Authority try to enforce some rule of law, particularly in response to acts of violence, there's almost a negotiation that has to happen. There isn't actually a real enforcement directly of law, because those groups are seem to be too powerful for that. So my question for you is, when a group like ours operating in Israel, if we have an issue that we're trying to raise, we have appropriate places to raise it in the Israeli government, which is what we do. Where do we bring human rights violations by the Islamist groups in places like Lebanon or like the Palestinian territories, where it seems that the governments themselves are too weak to deal with them? How do we bring in the rule of law there in the context of a more powerful, I think, Islamism than what you're talking about in Europe?
Well, it's almost impossible, isn't it? So that's why the only solution, I believe, is a long-term solution to encourage an ideological critique of their ideas, so eventually we can win the war of hearts and minds. Because in the absence of that, Hezbollah pretty much control the whole of South Lebanon. Hamas pretty much control the Gaza Strip. And it's almost impossible to bring anyone to account for human rights violations when you've got the people who control the area, and I don't just mean politically, but they have a grip over the population in terms of their persuasion. They don't even believe in human rights. So why should they even respect the case you bring? They don't believe human rights. They think human rights is a tool invented by colonialists to weaken Islam. And then Islam has got its Sharia rights, which contradict human rights as far as they're concerned. Because they insist on adhering to an ideological interpretation, which means the framework leads to them seeing human rights as an extension of capitalism and its cultural invasion. And you will only see that if you think of things in the terms of the ideological struggle. So I really don't see a solution apart from encouraging civil society and getting involved from a civil society angle in this debate to really weaken the appeal of the Islamist ideology. And it's a long-term struggle. We've got a long way ahead of us to go.
Hello, I'm Rania from the Australian Embassy. I have two questions, but you've partially answered the first, so you don't have to dwell on it. And the first one was, what are the arguments you're actually using to refute the Islamist meta-narrative? And the second one is more about how you're actually communicating that to your audience, which are the Islamists, and what tools you're using or how you're getting your message out there.
Okay, the arguments in detail, I don't think we'll have time to go through them now. Okay, the last event was actually quite detailed on that, but I'm writing a book on that subject, okay. And Matt just asked me to plug the book.
Well, it's a good plug for his book. Plus, yeah. This previous lecture, which did go into in great length,
will be on the Foundation's website eventually, and Jeff will hopefully sort that out there. Yeah. Hopefully with no complications, Jeff. Quilliamfoundation.org, all one word. That's Quilliam, foundation.org. It's also on my cards. If anyone wants a card, I'll have some here at the front, and it's on the back of the card as well. So the arguments there will be in the book. How we go about speaking to these people, we're in constant touch with members of these organizations, and we have set up a task force. We have set up a counter-radicalization unit that's developed a curriculum that aims to go up and down the trouble spots of Europe, specifically in the UK and generally in Europe, and eventually, hopefully, we'll replicate that model to access these people directly and sit down and engage with them. As non-government actors, we believe it's our role to engage with these guys to convince them, because we would not then legitimize them. What we're concerned about is when government engages with them in official meetings, there's a danger of legitimization. But we can do that, and we can be a lot more frank and open about that as well. So we've set up this unit, and its aim is to go around, as well as training, which I mentioned before, to train agencies, it's also to go around making direct contact on the ground to pull these people out of these organizations and to generally popularize the counter-ideology. And yeah, if you watch the website, hopefully you'll hear more about these sorts of things in the coming weeks and months.
Yes, in the back. No, don't turn around, I'm looking right at you. There you go.
Hi, is this working?
Yeah.
What's the Quillian Foundation's view on the Muslim Council of Britain, your relationship with it, and also what's your view of its prominence in the press to non-Muslims? Because that's the view of Muslim society or overview that non-Muslims get in Britain.
Okay, you're another Brit, are you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yes. The MCB is set up by a Jamaat-inspired bunch. Jamaat-e Islami is the brotherhood equivalent of the Indian subcontinent. The MCB and its spokesman initially refused to condemn the 7/7 bombings. It took them a good few months to eventually come round to condemning those bombings in London. The MCB is not a representative organization. The MCB is an organization that represents the organized minority that up until the year 2000 or roundabouts controlled the disorganized majority. Since then, many other organizations have emerged, such as the BMF, which is the British Muslim Forum, headed by Khurshid Ahmed, not to be confused by the Khurshid Ahmed, who's the Jamaat-Islami senator in Pakistan. It's quite confusing. We sent the email to the wrong guy inviting them to our launch. And we got a response inviting us to their institution instead. So the BMF, the British Muslim Forum, is an umbrella organization that represents the Brelvi community in the UK, who are the Indian subcontinent version of Sufis, who happen to be the default majority community. That's the largest representative organization there. But because it wasn't sponsored by the government, as they had done with the MCB, and therefore they didn't claim to monopolize representation, it's not so well known. But the MCB and the government sponsor of the MCB has come to an end, and that phase, that era, has come to an end. The MCB, we don't feel, represents the community. It represents the interests of Islamists. And the UK government have realized that, and now they've set up the DCLG, the Department of Communities and Local Government, to deal with these issues on a case-by-case basis from local government upwards. And that's much more of a productive approach.
Brett?
Brett Stevens from the Wall Street Journal. Again, thank you for a really excellent talk. I was wondering if you could sort of describe and assess the state of Muslim clergy in Britain, and whether you think it is adequate to, in a sense, to your task. If you are going to de-Islamicize former members of or members of HT, is there a kind of Islam to which they can then repair, which will not ultimately lead them back into the same radical direction?
Excellent point. Now, this brings me to the point where it's an opportunity to say that leaving Islamism does not mean somebody leaves their faith. It does not mean somebody stops being a good Muslim. I'm not speaking about myself, but I'm talking about others. You know, someone who leaves Islamism may still be a very good Muslim, a very practicing Muslim in that sense, to coin a better phrase, want of a better phrase. And that's the key, that you have mosque imams and religious leaders up and down the UK who are not Islamists. They're just not equipped in dealing with the modern ideology of Islamism because it's alien to their own teachings, which in itself is a testimony to the modernity of Islamism. These guys have been madrasa graduates from the schools of Pakistan. They don't know how to deal with Islamism. They haven't come across it. And they're largely from the Brelvi tradition. Now, that de-radicalization unit, one of its tasks is also to train these imams, to teach them exactly what the ideology is, how to identify it, and how to critique it, which is something I testified in the Senate about, how to identify the ideology, how to differentiate this ideology between this ideology and the faith of Islam. And that's something where these mosque imams, they need training in. There have been some very positive developments in these religious leaders, and one of them is people like Osama Hassan, who's an advisor at the Quillian Foundation, is also independently a mosque imam and a lecturer at university, the University of Middlesex. In his youth, he'd gone to Afghanistan to train. Has left all of that behind. And an example of his stance on an issue which is quite controversial is the headscarves. He says that theologically, religiously, forget politically, because of course everyone has the freedom to choose not to wear it. He says religiously it's not mandatory for a Muslim woman, i.e. she's absolutely not sinful for uncovering her head. And this is somebody whose father is also a religious theologian, who's a mosque imam, has a firm grounding in theology. And that's an example of the sorts of voices that we're encouraging. And he has that background as well, where he used to be quite radical in his youth. But a lot of the imams, yeah, they do need some training.
Yes, ma'am.
Kimberly Dozier with CBS News. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay, it's still on. Testing 1, 2, 3. Kimberly Dozier with CBS News. You mentioned the one imam. You mentioned the one imam who has joined your cause. Have you reached out to organizations such as Al-Azhar? Do you have any of the senior clerics who are helping you reach out to populations in the Middle East?
Yeah, that was just an example. There are more than there's more than one. Another one is Dr. Musharraf, who's actually a graduate of Al-Azhar. He spoke at our launch. He's another advisor of ours, and he's founder of the Muslim Hands, a charity, quite a well-established community figure, and there are others. And yes, we've also reached out to Azhar. As I said, Ed Hussein has just got back from Egypt, where he met the Mufti of Egypt himself, Sheikh Ali Juma, a very well-learned man and a very progressive voice. And yes, in the past, he's mentioned, I think about 10 years ago, he mentioned some things, but the man has moved forward immensely. And he was largely responsible for the turnaround of Al-Gama'a al-Islamiyya in the Egyptian prisons, because he would personally go in to de-radicalize them. So it's a very encouraging voice there with the Mufti of Egypt. Ed Hussein met him, and he's been liaising with other Azhar ulama. And we've had some very good feedback from them behind the scenes. And we're hoping to very soon try and bring that to the fore. But definitely there are efforts there.
Mike in the back.
Majid, thank you for an excellent talk.
Thank you.
I had a question about some of the recruiting that you did for HT. You mentioned recruiting, obviously, not only in the UK, but in Denmark and other countries. Obviously, the local grievances are going to be different in every country. Is the HT model basically one size fits all, or does it account for differences in local grievances?
The only differences manifest themselves in the angle that we take. So, as I said, if we're in a country that is... as we were, say, in Pakistan, it's a failed state, relatively failed state, we would pick on the socioeconomic factors. There's a lot of poverty in Pakistan. We'd pick on those socioeconomic factors. But if HT is operating in a Gulf country, it would focus on the religious angle, that regardless of the fact that you're rich, you're still religiously obliged to remove this regime because it's not God's law. So it will adjust the angle, but it's still the one-size-fits-all in terms of the solution, which is the caliphate. So I think, briefly, I hope that answers your question.
Two questions. In the mic, if you can. Thank you.
The mic. Two questions. First of all, how do you counter a traditional Muslim who speaks about the responsibility to enforce what I would call communal law? Irrespective of governments and states, that exists, and traditionally within Islam, I think it does. That's the first question. Do you want to do them one at a time? Because the other one's kind of a little complex.
We only have a few minutes left. I'd like to get in as many.
Okay, so the second question is, I'll do the, you choose either one, I guess, is from a theoretical perspective, there are people who, using the analogy of a train with an engine and cars behind it, who say that the engine is the power of the group. The individual current leader is another option. The third would be the original ideologue, who could be dead. And the fourth is the ideology. I've heard all of those identified as the driving engine. So I'm interested in that, and also your thoughts on communal Sharia.
Okay. Very quickly, the latter part, that depends from group to group. HT is a very ideological organization. Others, such as... say, Al-Gama'a al-Islamiyya were very much personality-based. Umar Abdurrahman, who's in prison here, was a big personality amongst them, and his face was well-known. As an example, HT, no one still knows, members included, they still do not know where their leader is and what he looks like. He definitely exists. He's been in prison before in Jordan, but he goes underground and he doesn't really make anything of himself because it's the ideology that's deemed to be more important. So that is group to group, it differs. Ikhwan are very much about personalities. Qardawi is a very leading figure, even their leadership, because they're less ideological, they're more about community work and social work with a view to generally bringing about Islamicization. So it differs from group to group. The other question about communal law, it's quite easy to deal with. But short of getting into a complex theological discussion, I'd just say that that the Sharia was designed to bring about aims of the Sharia, known in Islamic jurisprudence as maqasid al-Sharia, the aims of justice, preserving life, liberty, property. There are certain aims which Imam al-Suyuti, a medieval jurist, actually articulated in his book, and he called them maqasid al-Sharia, the aims. And you can talk about those in the sense of certain inalienable rights that somebody would have. So when the Archbishop recently in the UK spoke about Sharia law being applied in certain communal cases and certain communal examples, I was one of the people that came out and said, well, this is actually a red herring. Because first, the reason why it's a red herring is that Muslims, when they get married, the marriage is effective immediately as soon as we exchange our agreement between a man and a woman before God. It's effective immediately. Historically, there's never been a need for a state to ratify that marriage because the relationship goes straight through God without the need for a clergy. So if I was there with a woman, and she and I both agreed. No, see, I'm sorry, Zeno, but I can assure you, where's she gone? She's gone. She said that, because my hotel's in a homosexual district, so she was advising me. There she is. I'm not homosexual. Right. She and I, if we were to exchange vows, that would be effectively immediately without the need for a state to recognize that. So when you talk about now marriage laws being recognized by the British state, as the Archbishop did, well, the reason why that's a red herring is because religiously they're already recognized, and to get them then to go and be recognized by a state is simply a civil procedure, and that process already exists. We have British civil law for marriages. So in fact, it doesn't change anything, because even if you made it Sharia compliant, it would still be immediately effective from the moment the man and woman have exchanged their vows. To go and register it in a state would simply be another civil procedure. And if you already have a civil procedure, why create a second one? If that makes sense, I'm trying to keep it very simplified, but even in Egypt, it's the same thing. They have this phenomenon called Zawaj al-Urfi, which is actually that teenagers in universities, because they're all a bit, young and hip, they want to have relationships with each other. They exchange their Islamic vows with each other, and all they do is they just don't bother registering it with the authorities. That doesn't mean that they are not Islamically in a relationship, because that the exchange of those vows is between the two people and God. And as long as you adhere to a certain ritual, that's acceptable. And there was never, Islam grew in Arab Bedouin tradition when there wasn't a state that had to put a rubber stamp on every marriage. So it's a red herring, and that's the way we explain it to people.
Is the mic on? Thank you.
You had said something before that first Israel is the target, after that the rest of the world. That would indicate that really this is not a radical Muslim versus Jew or Israel. It is much bigger than that. Of course, the whole world doesn't necessarily recognize that. Many people think that Israel is the problem. If that was out of the way, there wouldn't be a bigger plan. Could you elaborate on that bigger plan?
Yes, absolutely right. Hizb ut-Tahrir have a book called Hizb ut-Tahrir. It's a blue, in English, it's available in blue with white writing on the front. In the back of that book, they've got a section called Foreign Policy. In the section on foreign policy, they say that jihad is the religious obligation of the caliphate to attack its neighboring countries and to invite them either, one, to become Muslim, two, to submit to the authority of the caliphate. Obviously, the assumption in the first one is if they're Muslim, they will already have submitted. Two, to submit to the authority of the caliphate by paying the head tax, the jizya, or three, to attack them and to fight them and to declare jihad against them, even if they did not start the attack against us. That's the foreign policy of HT's caliphate. It's to attack the world, to eventually aim to conquer them. That idea emerged from Nabahani's influences from communism, with the whole expansionist USSR, seeing the world in competing blocks. That's the real problem. Israel, for them, is simply something which is what they call a cancer in our midst that we need to remove. That's not actually the real target. The real target is to control the world. It sounds a bit fanciful, but that's their aim.
So then what you're saying is 9/11 was just a preview?
Well, no, but see, the thing is that, not to speculate there's going to be something bigger, I don't know. But what I'm saying is 9/11, we saw way before that a microcosm in Newham College with the murder of that student. It's a natural manifestation of this ideology. And if these people get into power, then it will be a preview.
Yes, in the front.
Sorry, very quickly, because they sent me to Pakistan because it acquired a nuclear bomb, and they wanted that nuclear bomb for the caliphate.
Thank you, Mr. Rashid, for this effort. I have two questions, and you partially answered some of it. So just talking about the Western Islam, and if we know about the Western freedom of women, how can the Western Islam deal with that, starting with the dress and finishing with the inheritance, going by the right for a single mother to exist in homosexuality? The second question is, how would the Western Islam survive in a Muslim society, knowing that in a non-Muslim society, knowing that the Islamist mindset can be based on taking the lead to ruling? Should it be just Muslim lifestyle instead of Islamist lifestyle? Islam and Christianity are both expansionist religions. What would become of a society when we have the two parties, each one thinks that it's the one that has the word of God? Does dialogue help in this case, especially if the core mission is to convert the other?
Thank you.
Feel free to choose some of those.
Yeah, I'll focus on the, I think the important one is homosexuality, inheritance, and all of these problematic areas. There's an assumption made, sadly, by Muslims and non-Muslims that Islam is a fixed monolithic whole that's frozen in a medieval interpretation. And that's the assumption which we're hoping to challenge. There's absolutely no reason why Islam cannot be reinterpreted, no reason whatsoever. And there's no reason why a medieval interpretation is more authentic than a modern-day interpretation. In theology, obviously, we're talking about theology here. We're not talking about ruling now, because, again, we're separating the two. But even just for Muslim law, just for Muslims in their moral code of conduct, there's absolutely no reason why a modern-day interpretation, a contemporary interpretation, is less valid than some guy who sat in the medieval period and decided that he would interpret the religion in a way where homosexuals need to be thrown off the highest cliff, as HT would say. Yeah. So this whole thing can be reinterpreted. And just to pick on that one example of homosexuality, the evidence that they cite, the prophetic tradition they cite about homosexuals, and they say that they need to be executed by being thrown off the highest building, and that's HT's line on this. It's quite extreme. The tradition they cite is mentioned by leading theologians such as Imam al-Shawkani in Nailul Altar, Imam Asqalani in Fath al-Bari. It's mentioned that this tradition, these traditions, there's a few of them, they're all known as hadith da'ifa, weak narrations. Because the whole prophetic, the whole hadith narration thing, it's a science. You have to look at the chain of transmission. You have to analyze the historiography and the historicity of these chains to determine whether it's an authentic or an inauthentic tradition. And there's so much room for difference over that. So these two imams, despite doing what is known as taqlid, or imitating this school of thought's position on this, which is the medieval stance, which was actually the same throughout the world, that homosexuality was seen as an abomination, they actually, when speaking of the traditions themselves, said these traditions are weak. So all I'm saying, without prescribing anything, because I'm not a mufti, what I'm saying is there's no reason why a modern interpretation has less authority than a medieval one.
Someone I can partially see behind the pillar. Yes. Into the mic. Thank you.
You were talking about modern interpretation of Islam.
You're British?
Yes.
My God.
Sorry, we're all British. And earlier you were saying how some of the conservative elements of Islam identified with the Islamists. So how do you deal with the problem that by expanding a more modern Western version of Islam, you're isolating these more conservative elements who then have more reason to sort of join forces with the Islamists?
Great question. There are people other than myself who are theologians, qualified theologians, who are dealing with that directly. In the UK, people like Dr. Musharraf, Osama Hassan, are dealing with that head-on by using the paradigms of conservative Muslims to demonstrate the possibility of reinterpretation by adhering to the same principles of interpretation. You're not going to disappear behind there, are you? Right, okay. Right, okay. Jeff, be nice to the lady. Right, okay. There are leading voices that are involved in that who are qualified theologians. Now, Islamists tend to take on the mantle of thinking they're qualified theologians when they're not. So I did that when I was with HT. So I'm very careful, despite the fact that I've studied in detail in prison the principles of theology, of religious Islamic theology, and I've studied in detail the Arabic language. I've graduated in Arabic. I will not give a fatwa. But there are people that are qualified. In the States, there are people, again, very good people that are doing that. Amina Wadood, who's seen as a feminist Muslim, Sherman Jackson, Omar Abdullah, Imam Hamza Yusuf. There are very good progressive voices who are using the tradition to push forward a progressive agenda from within the framework of tradition. And our role as Quilliam Foundation is to encourage that.
We have room, time for just a couple more questions, and what we'll do is we'll take them in succession, and then you lance them together. So right in the back of this row, and then in the back section as well.
Stuart Sloan from the American Jewish Committee. You made the point that with respect to grievances, that states, specifically, I think you mentioned Europe, should take action to remove these so-called grievances. Would you characterize the French ban on head covers in public schools as a grievance that should be corrected?
And ma'am, you too.
You mentioned that you're recommending Muslims act on a nationalist basis, get involved in local politics, However, Western teaching on Islam is that Islam does not recognize nationalist boundaries and differences between nation states. So I'm wondering, how do you counter that and encourage Muslims to act within local politics from a nationalistic basis?
I'm really happy you asked that, actually. It proves my point that the Islamism has affected Western teaching of Islam. The hijab ban first. Yes, the hijab ban is a grievance. I'm not a secular fundamentalist, but it's a grievance not because of my religion. If there was a cross ban, crucifix ban, I'd be just as aggrieved, because I don't believe in banning ostensible signs of religion, even in schools, and I think the British model is better. What I do insist on, however, is that religious tolerance has limits. Those limits are health and safety, public security. So I actually wrote a paper on this because, as part of my political science, political theory masters in the London School of Economics, one of my modules was multiculturalism. My lecturer is actually a well-known cultural relativist, Chandran Kukathas, who I had many a debate with. But on this issue, I wrote a paper because I think there are limits, and the limits have to be health and safety. So I argued, for example, that Sikhs in the UK currently have the right to carry knives as one of the 5 Ks. Now, that's not 3 Ks, not KKK, but they're 5 pillars of faith, being the shorts, the turban, the bangle, the knife, and something else, the long hair. They have a legal right to carry a knife on them as part of their religious freedoms. And my argument was that for health and safety and security, there's no less danger of a drunk Sikh stabbing somebody. Knife crime is a big thing at the moment in the UK. So there's no less danger of a drunk Sikh stabbing somebody than somebody who's a non-Sikh. So if a knife is a threat to the public, it should be a threat regardless of who the person is. Just because he's a Sikh, it doesn't mean he's less likely to stab somebody. And that was my argument. So religious freedoms have limits. The tolerance for religious rights have limits, and they have to be when it's health and safety issues. I don't see the headscarf as a problem with health and safety. The face covering, the niqab, is a problem, because you can't have a passport photograph without showing your face. And that is clearly a security problem. So I've provided that framework, in my view, as a framework through which to help decide on this issue. The national boundaries question is a classic example of the Islamist influence in Western teaching of Islam. The companions of the Prophet were themselves called by their nationalities. We had Salman al-Farsi, Salman the Persian, Bilal al-Habashi, Bilal the Ethiopian, Shu'aib al-Rumi, Shu'aib the Roman. Now, Salman al-Farsi, the Persian, was identified with being from Persia when the Persians were fighting the Muslims, the Arabs. Yeah? Shu'aib al-Rumi, when the Arabs were fighting the Romans, and he was identified as being a Roman. It had nothing to do with you're from the enemy land, you shouldn't call yourself Roman, or you shouldn't call yourself Persian. This was where they were from. The whole notion that Islam doesn't recognize nationalism, I asked them to bring me one Quranic passage or hadith that says nationalism is not recognized. What they do, and what I used to do, is bring a passage, hadith actually, that talks about asabiyya in Arabic. Asabiyya doesn't mean nationalism. Nationalism is actually, in Arabic, it's actually qawmiyya, or wataniyya is patriotism. But asabiyya, which is the only evidence that Tahrir and other Islamists use to say that nationalism is prohibited, asabiyya actually means something completely and entirely different. It comes from asabi, which is nervousness, and it means the blind tribal wars and allegiances that are known to have occurred when we're talking about sort of like protracted conflicts over things such as a camel rope and blind killing of each other. That was what was called asabiyya. Modern-day nation-states is a modern concept, and so it's a process of interpretation to call that, to say that asabiyya means nationalism, when even the word is different. The word is qawmiyya.
Majid, this has been a fantastic discussion, preceded by a wonderful lecture. We thank you very, very much for making the time during your brief stay here to factor us in. Thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking Majid.